Do you have a picture in your head of what a public library looks like? Small town public library? Chances are pretty good that it's a brick building, two stories tall with kind of like a daylight basement thing on the bottom. And when you walk into the library on the main floor, you're going up a flight of stairs and you're on like the second floor. And it's kind of square and kind of boxy, and usually there's trees all around it. And you know what? That's a Carnegie Library. Hundreds and hundreds of these libraries were built all the way across the United States. And of all the states in the Union, Oregon embraced the Carnegie Library program like no other place. 32 towns in Oregon that were offered a grant to build a library, and not a single one failed to raise its matching money. No other state was this successful, although a couple other states did actually build more libraries. I'll tell you all about this in just a second. First, I want to introduce myself. I'm Finn J.D. John, and I write a weekly newspaper column that runs in about a dozen papers around the state right now, and it's called Offbeat Oregon History. I've been writing it since 2008, and right now there are about 175 published episodes in the kitty. So every morning, I pull one of those episodes up off the archive and put it onto the daily RSS feeds, one of them in text and pictures for your newsreader, and the other one in audio only for your podcatcher, which is what you're listening to right now. Offbeat Oregon History tells the stories of Oregon history that nobody knows about, or the ones everyone has forgotten. Stories of heroes and rascals, of shipwrecks and lost gold, of Shanghai'd sailors and Skid Row bordellos and pirates and robbers and buried treasure and unsolved mysteries. Today's episode was first published on September 25th, 2011. I'm going to read it to you now. If you walked into a city library in the mid-1880s, chances are you wouldn't even recognize it. First off, if you were under 12 years old at the time, you wouldn't even be let in the door. Children just weren't let in. But if you were of the appropriate age, what you'd find is a room with chairs and a desk and usually no windows. Behind that desk would be a librarian. You would have to know what book you wanted so that you could ask the librarian for it. At that point, a library clerk would scurry back into the book hall to retrieve it. The book hall was a massive room with walls formed in alcoves to maximize shelf space. The bookshelves were two stories high, with a little balcony running around it for the clerk to access the second story's books. The whole vision of a library in those days of expensive vellum volumes and great social inequality was as a treasure house of books, which must be protected from pilferage by an untrustworthy public. Today's vision of open stacks with borrowers freely browsing through the collection, that would have horrified a 19th century library architect. Libraries back then were not designed with the poor, hardworking immigrant in mind. Libraries sought to serve the sort of folks who, with a straight face, habitually referred to themselves as the better class of people. The sort who valued great literature, or at least valued being seen with great literature. But in the 20 years after 1890, this vision of the library was utterly transformed. The average American city library went from a dark, secretive, and magnificent palace like a necromancer's hall to a light, open, egalitarian place in which everyone in town was welcome to come and paw the collection, in which a special area was set aside for children, with comfortable furniture and shelves that everyone could reach. A big part of this transformation was the spending spree that Andrew Carnegie embarked on at about the same time, the industrialized program of library building in towns and cities around the world. And because it happened just as Oregon was starting to build its cities, it had a really big impact here. No fewer than 32 municipal libraries were built in the state with Carnegie money. On a per capita basis, Oregon built more libraries than all but a handful of other states, roughly one library for every 2,500 citizens. And Oregon is the only state in the country in which not a single community that was offered a Carnegie library failed to raise its matching funds and levy its maintenance and staffing tax, which was 10% of construction costs per year, to qualify. Part of the reason that Oregon in particular, and the western states in general, responded so well to Carnegie's library program is its basic egalitarianism. Actually, Carnegie revolutionized philanthropy with this program. Earlier philanthropists had taken a direct personal and paternal interest in their projects, making large and magnificent monuments to their own eminence or in places they had a personal connection with, and expecting gratitude in return. Now, Carnegie did try this. Carnegie Hall in Pittsburgh was built that way. But then he threw that model aside and replaced it with an industrialized system. To get a Carnegie Library built in your community, you didn't come to the big man himself with your hat in your hand. You submitted an application to his staff, people who didn't know you and didn't want to know you, whose job was simply to evaluate your city's application. It did not, in theory, matter if you came from the most prominent family in town or had just stepped off a boat from Sicily. What's not to like? Well, in a number of the more easterly states, this approach did cause problems. The upper-class folks who formed local library boards of trustees tended to prefer the older model, one in which the library included some built-in barriers to filter out, quote, undesirable types. A library could be a great place to be seen cultivating one's upper-class appreciation for culture if only those scruffy Polish or Italian or Irish immigrants and their unkempt children could be somehow kept at arm's length. In response to this trend, Carnegie's secretary, James Bertram, became quite strict about library designs. Wastefully sumptuous meeting rooms for the trustees, excessively magnificent entryways, and decorative elements meant to impress were all a one-way ticket to his no list. Wise towns studied the sample layouts he included with each application packet and built something very similar to something in it. And towns that were committed to the vision of a library as something to reinforce class distinctions either were turned down or just didn't apply. Sure, that sort of snobbishness was a problem in Oregon, too. But the state was young enough that many of its wealthy citizens still remembered what it was like to be fresh off the boat from somewhere with nothing in their pockets. Carnegie's goal of crossing class divisions with his library sounded just fine to them. There were other reasons, too, for a community to turn down Carnegie's money. Carnegie actually was a fairly ruthless businessman. Some of his methods had made him enemies. In general, the farther away from Pittsburgh a city was, the less likely it was to think of his gift as tainted money and refuse it on moral grounds. In 1919, when Carnegie stopped funding library construction, he'd given away $40 million of his pile on this one project alone. But it was still a relatively small slice of the total of $350 million that the guy gave away in his lifetime. That represented roughly 90% of his fortune. In the process, he'd made educational materials and literature available to millions of people, especially children in western states like Oregon. Through Bertram's jaded eye, he'd helped transform the popular vision of a public library from a dark, intimidating temple of a hostile god into a bright, wide-open public square. And he'd probably made it possible for children in Oregon and other western states to grow up and go forth and change the world. That's all I've got for you today. You can read any archive article and subscribe to either daily feed by going to the website at offbeatoregon.com. Both feeds are optimized for smartphone use, but they work great on a tablet or a netbook, or even an old-fashioned computer. All the columns are covered under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license. Thanks for listening, and do drop me a line if you're ever in Corvallis and have time for a cup of coffee. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @OffbeatOregon. Have a great day.